Welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast, where our job is to help you build visibility, professional credibility, and connection with your ideal client by putting the human at the center of innovative marketing, so you can build and strengthen an engaging, enduring relationship with your ideal clients. I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm honored that you're here with me. If you haven't joined our wonderful marketing transformation community yet, go to innovabiz.co and collect your free gift as well. Do subscribe to the show and also leave a review because it helps others find us. Let's get into today's masterclass on this InnovaBuzz podcast.
If you want to be more innovative, you have to be more inquisitive. You have to go look for problems. You have to go look for ideas. You have to go look for the people who you can combine in one place to actually deliver things. And you have to figure out how to use every sociological trick in the book to get small groups of people to collide and catalyze on something and then get them to drive forward. It's not a one-person game. The more diverse a group you have in the room, the better off you are.
Welcome back. I hope you've had an awesome week so far. Now, if you haven't yet listened to my recent conversations with author and master inventor Neil Sahota and with the team from Papillon, Sonia Zeebeck and Dan Archow, then check them out, but only after you've listened to today's conversation. Now, I'm really excited today to have on the InnovaBuzz podcast as my guest, Pete Newell. Pete is a nationally recognized innovation expert whose work is transforming how the government in the US and other large organizations compete and drive growth. He's a retired Army colonel. He's CEO of BMNT, which is a Palo Alto-based innovation consultancy and early-stage incubator that helps solve some of the hardest real-world problems in national security, in state and local governments, and beyond. Pete is also co-author with Lean Startup founder Steve Blank of Hacking for Defense, an academic program taught at 40-plus universities that teaches students how to quickly solve critical national security problems while performing a national service. Prior to joining BMNT, Pete was director of the US Army's Rapid Equipping Force, charged with rapidly finding, integrating, and employing solutions to emerging problems faced by soldiers on the battlefield. In our discussion today, Pete talked to me about the idea of practicing risk-taking in a safe environment to learn about the value of failure. We talked about moving from a product-centric to a problem-centric mindset. And Pete explained the art of discovery, the best way to get over your fears and to test your ideas. Without further ado, then, let's fly into the hive and get the buzz from Pete Newell. Hi, I'm your host, Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm really excited to welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast today from Austin in Texas in the USA, Peter Newell, who's the founder and CEO of BMNT, an innovation consultancy and early stage technology incubator that works with national security organizations to rapidly solve challenging problems. Pete's also co-host of the Innovators Radio show and podcast. Welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast, Pete. It's a great privilege to have you as my guest.
Now, thanks so much for the invite. I'm glad to be here.
Now, both Alexander Osterwalder and Steve Blank, who have been previous guests on the show, I've got Steve down as episode 326. I haven't noted down Alex's episode number, but they both suggested we have a chat with you, Pete. So big hello to Alex and Steve.
Yeah, they're good people, so I'm glad to have the opportunity to follow them just about anywhere.
Yeah, we had great conversation with them about all things strategy and
mapping out strategy and lean startup methodology. So I know you've been heavily involved in that, and you've also co-founded the Hacking for Defense program that's taught in more than 20 universities in the US, and that combines the best from your background in the military as well as successful Silicon Valley startups. So I'm really excited to dig some more into that. But tell us a little bit about what inspired you to start BMNT and the work you do today.
So I was actually a career Army officer who retired in 2013. When I spent the bulk of my career at the tactical infantry unit. So I don't have Steve or Alex's background. I wasn't a scientist. I'm not an engineer, and I certainly wasn't an entrepreneur. I literally spent a lot of time on the battlefields around the world, and most of my time, training soldiers to go to war. And that, quite frankly, I thought that's what I was going to do until I retired and I'd be done. At the end of my career, I was in Iraq on my last tour, and the next job they assigned to me was running an organization called the Army's Rapid Equipping Force, which is essentially the U.S. Army's Skunk Works. Yeah, and it was an organization that hadn't been around very long. I was, I think, the fourth director of the organization. It had the mission of finding problems on a battlefield, finding emerging technologies coming out of the commercial world, and very rapidly integrating that technology so it would solve those problems on the battlefield. And during the 3 years I was in the organization, I realized that as well built as the organization was, it had become product centric, and it was very focused on what the next big thing or cool thing they could put on the battlefield was. And quite frankly, I thought they were missing the opportunity, which was to observe problems as they were starting to bubble up, get the early signs that they were there, looking over people's shoulders, and essentially not just solving the problem themselves, but actually pulling that problem off the battlefield and translating it into something that made sense to other people, and then using that translation to attract a wider group of people to work on it much faster and deliver a better solution. So when it came time for my next assignment, we basically told you're going to be a general. You're going to go off and essentially run a strategic initiative group for somebody. And I realized at that point that I had become addicted to problem solving and extracting problems from the battlefield. And I politely turned down the next assignment and followed that immediately with the realization that there was no way that the Army would ever let me continue to do what I was doing. I would have to move on, move out, whatever else. So I decided to retire. And in and around my travels place, I had spent some time in Silicon Valley and was eventually, attracted to go back there by a couple of Stanford professors who were, they were writing a book called Scaling Up Excellence, Bob Sutton and Huggy Rao. And what they wanted to do was actually they wanted to do a case study on my time at the Rapid Equipping Force. We had been, wildly successful. I'd actually invested about $1.5 billion of the U.S. government's money in some pretty exotic technologies that had a massive impact on the battlefield in a very short period of time. So Huggy and Bob actually hired a case study writer, and he spent, probably 90 days tearing apart everything I had done at the Rapid Equipment Course. And it gave me an opportunity to see what the real issues were. And kind of out of that bloomed the idea of, you could really do this from the outside looking in as an ombudsman to the system. I understood pretty much Silicon Valley. I understood startups a little bit. I understood the Defense Department massively. And the original premise was not can we sell commercial tech to the government, but can we get the government to be a better partner to sell to. So it was more about training the government to behave better in the startup ecosystem, which they did not understand very well at all. So the premise for BMNT was really the understanding that emerging technology cuts both ways. It can either be your best friend or your worst enemy, depending on, you know, which side of the fence you're sitting on. But it was important to ensure that the young men and women in service had an opportunity to get their hands on the best technology the world had to offer to solve their really hard problems. So that was the premise for BMNT when we started.
That's fascinating. So when you went into the Rapid Equipping Force role and you decided that this was the wrong way around, so it was basically product driven, how did you have a strategy for going about changing that? How did you kind of tackle that?
You know, it was funny because when I took over the organization, the guy I replaced was already gone, and the staff basically gave me a chapter and verse on all the people I shouldn't talk to because they hated what Ralph was doing, and gave me a list of people I needed to talk to, and they would tell me how refs should work. And so I took the list of people that I shouldn't talk to, and I went to them first. And I went to everybody who was angry at ref because ref had done something, you know, offensive to them, or essentially the acquisition system that they were telling you guys suck and you can't do this. You need us to do it for you. And I learned a lot about the pain that we were inflicting on other people. I also learned a lot about the pain points that other people had that I thought the Rapid Equipping Force could make go away without destroying organizations or reputations or things like that. So it was a classic Steve Blank, get out of the office. I got out of the office and spent a lot of time talking to other people about what we did that eventually led me to the understanding of that we needed to create a better relationship and be more helpful of people whose job it was to deliver something and do things right. Couldn't because they didn't have all the tools that we could apply. But rather than do it for them, the mantra was do it with them. Convince them it was an important thing to do. The other thing I actually did, I had not been to Afghanistan in a long time. So I showed up on the battlefield in Afghanistan in September, October of 2010 and just started talking to other commanders who were my peers about some of the issues that they were facing. And what I found was this humongous gap between the reality of what they were doing and what the higher level commands thought their problems were, because it took forever for the problems to percolate to the top and to be staffed and turned into a priority list. And you know, what I found was that the things that were killing people today weren't on a priority list someplace else. And that really, that set the tone for my going back and looking at my own organization and say, you know, we have all the permission and access in the world to go do that, but we're not, and we're out of place. So I took the discovery I did from those two iterations, and then essentially realized that we needed to be further out on the edge of the battlefield with the right types of people who understood the battlefield, could sit in a dining facility and talk to guys coming off of patrol and start to pull information out. And at the same time, they had to have a MacGyver-like mentality where they could go in a machine shop real quick and cobble together an MVP or something that looked like the issue and turn that into kind of a technical data package and send back to the rest of us. At the same time, I had to build a better ecosystem of potential problem solvers and funders and contracting officers and other folks, so that when I got something, I could rapidly assemble a group around a problem, build its own baby ecosystem, which would have its own language for what that issue was, and then could agitate them to actually take action on something. So I was very deliberate about changing the focus of the organization to be more problem-centric rather than product-centric. And it got to the point where I stopped talking about the products we were delivering. And I simply would talk about the top 10 problem areas we were trying to solve and the data behind those and the projects we were working to help us better understand them and attack those. And I started to pay more attention to my problem generators downrange, right, rather than the product builders. Eventually I'd get to them, but I pushed out to the battlefield that I really wanted people out the farthest edge of the reaches where they would see things in real time and could help us speed up the process of understanding.
It's fascinating. And so how did you change the culture? I'm guessing there was probably a bit of a cultural thing around product-centric. How did you change the culture to bring about the changes you've described?
I became a very vocal advocate of what I expected. The challenges were, particularly in the military, you can't just fire people for not doing what you don't want them, So it took some time for me to actually lead people by the neck or by the nose, or push them or prod them into doing the thing the way that I wanted them to do. I started sending them away to school. I sent a bunch of executive coaches at MIT and had them sit in particular courses with other executives from, corporations around the world, with the intent of them learning the way they looked at the world and problems and how they generated things. And then I would bring that understanding back and rebuild it to a process that we could use. So I would say it took me 6 months to understand that we had a problem. It took me another 6 months to learn and pick a direction we needed to go in solving it, and then probably another year of actually building the processes and the system and aligning people and getting enough successes so that I could show them we are being successful and this is the way we need to go. So I would probably say it was 2 years into it before we really hit our stride.
Yeah, there's a theme there, though, the reaching out and getting out of the office, isn't there? So sending people out to training to interact with people from other industries outside the military business, and as well as getting people out into the field to see the problems that the customers, if you like, were facing on a day-to-day basis out in the real world, in the battlefield.
What I tell people today is you can't take a shortcut in doing discovery and getting out of the office and talking to people. It has to be endemic to every system, every process you have. And that should be second nature with anybody involved in innovation is, I got an idea. Great. Let me go talk to 10 people outside my office that may not agree with me. I think that's the one thing that I continue to teach people today is, when you have a great idea, go find 10 curmudgeons who will tell you it's a dumb idea or it sucks. Yeah. And start getting feedback before you talk to the cheerleading crowd that's going to clap and rave about how smart you are. You really have to chase that diversity of thought before you get that comfort factor that you could take the next step.
So go find those people that conventional wisdom would say don't talk to them.
That's exactly right.
Okay. So what are some of the key lessons from your military career, in particular that experience with the rapid equipping force that you've taken into business?
So the first is what was most transferable is what I learned about the OODA loop, which is a kind of a military term that essentially describes the process of observing something that's changing, orienting on it so that you better understand it, deciding what you're going to do, and then taking action, and then going back to observing it. So OODA is the short term for an OODA loop. It was actually a process that was developed by an Air Force pilot back in the 1960s. Yeah, and essentially what they had learned was that between 1950 and the Korean War and Vietnam, in the Korean War, I want to say that for every one U.S. aircraft we lost in combat, the enemy lost 13. By the time they got to Vietnam, it was like 1-3. And essentially what he described is that we're not thinking faster than our enemy in real time. the challenge we have today with technology isn't, I tell people, the concept of technological dominance, of putting some tech out there and dominating everything, is temporal at best. You're only going to be there until somebody either not comes up with something better, or until they figure out to go somewhere around it or completely use something else. So at least in combat, the idea of speed as being the huge advantage. How fast you can gather data on the battlefield and translate what you learned and saw into something that gets a group to orient on it, and how fast you can get that group to boil something down and distill and take action and decide what to do, and actually build an ecosystem that'll act. The speed at which you do that will determine whether you survive or not. The challenge with tech today is that tech is coming at us so fast and being adopted and adapted by the people who adopt it so fast, our OODA loops are challenged or broken. And in many cases, people are getting inside them. You see that happen in business just as much as you see it happen anywhere else. You look at things like Uber or Airbnb, and the taxi industry got set on its ear by Uber. And Uber simply moved faster than they could think their way of how to prevent them from doing things. Same thing with the hotel industry. It was that speed of whole chain that you saw that made a big difference. So I think first and foremost, the concept of an OODA loop and understanding that it's all about how fast that loop turns that determines whether you're going to be successful over the long term or not. And it's less about how cool your tech is than it is about how well you built your infrastructure and ecosystem that actually helps you learn what you need to learn in order to keep that loop spinning. That's first and foremost. I think the other thing, particularly when it comes to innovation, is that I would say that we have overused the word innovation without adequately understanding what we meant. And when we made the mistake years ago of, looking at these skunk works and saying, innovation only happens over here in left field. And we don't let anybody touch them because we don't want to get them slowed down, is you have to realize that that's an idea factory. That's not innovation. You don't get innovation until that stuff comes back and gets scaled and applied to an organization and used by a user to actually solve a problem. So if innovation isn't part of the entire ecosystem of your organization, you will never see the fruition of the generation of a bunch of ideas. And so the innovation platforms, if they don't include finance people and human resources and contracting and acquisitions and all those things necessary, then you're going to continue to find yourself creating a bunch of ideas that never go anywhere. Or short-term pilots that never make the leap into the mainstream of the system. The challenge that I think particularly in a business world and even in the Department of Defense is we have a doctrine for just about everything we do. For war fighting and shipbuilding, and there's a doctrine that says, this is how you do it. This is what the language is for. These are the roles that everybody plays. Yet when it comes to innovation, there's no doctrine. Nobody can explain the relationship of innovation to war fighting and how the two should fit together. So we continue to put band-aids on things over and over and over again, trying to explain why one should work with the other. The same thing happens in the business world. That there is no doctrinal standard for what innovation is supposed to do for the business, and nor the linkages between the innovation cells and the actual business itself, the business line that have the scale. It's really hard for a lot of organizations to see it both ways.
Yeah, there's so much to unpick there. I think one of the key things you said for me is, it's not innovation until you get action and it's turned into something that the user actually uses to solve the problem. And the other one, the innovation doctrine, I mean, I see that as, there is actually a process for innovation, and there's some really good books around, how to get great ideas and how to turn them into products or services that can disrupt an industry. And yet people think it's something that, it's just a light bulb that goes off and comes to them in a moment of inspiration.
You know, and it's fascinating sometimes. I say almost every tech problem we see today has a business process issue, a business process and a policy issue attached to it. So you can't just innovate around the technology if you don't understand the business process for actually applying the technology or the policies that you may have to change or temporarily lift so you can get enough experience with the technology in the business line in order to understand what the real impact is going to be. Then unfortunately, everybody wants the perfect answer before they do everything. I've been particularly hard on HR managers because, you know, oftentimes what we'll find is a cross-functional team will come together and will understand a problem and they'll come up with some potential solutions and pathways to deliver that problem. Yet, because the group came from four different places in the organization can't figure out how to temporarily reassign them to run that project to be the startup that does something. They immediately want to flip it to somebody else and send those people back to where they came from. Nowhere in the startup world would a venture capitalist look at a team of entrepreneurs and say, that's a great idea, I'm ready to fund you, only to have them say, that's great, now we're going to hand it to a new team. Yet in the government and inside businesses, they do that all the time.
Yeah, that reminds me, we had back in my corporate world, we had actually an innovation process where we had this cross-functional team and for a while there, it worked really well because we had the license to say these people, whether their nominal role was HR or finance or marketing or sales or production, whatever it might be, they were part of this team and that was their role and it was assigned. And that worked really well for a time. And then, of course, the day-to-day tasks suddenly took over and we'd find then that somebody would say, no, I've got to go and do some HR work or some whatever. And so it kind of, there was always that conflict.
I think the other thing that I've learned, you know, particularly over the last couple of years, you know, from the outside looking in, is that there's nothing more powerful than a passionate problem owner, somebody who understands the problem they're solving with the technology or something else, because they become the first true champion. They don't have to be the innovator or the scientist or the person with the tech, but the true entrepreneur is the person who's looking at the problem saying, I'm not going to stop until I solve this. The challenge I'm starting to see in innovation teams is they start to pull those people in, and you realize that person needs to continue on with the problem. And he's going to have to leave the innovation incubator and go someplace else and needs to be replaced by somebody else. While there are people like Steve Blank who are serial entrepreneurs, you know, do it over and over again. And you know, those are people who are, they're driven by solving problems, but they only take one problem at a time. They work on a lot of things until something gets their attention, and then that's what they're going to do. That's Steve Blank with this mission-driven entrepreneurship, hacking for defense, environment, lean. That's what Steve has done for 10 years and probably what he'll continue to do for another 10 years. There are other people who are passionate about one thing, and they're going to work like dogs to get it done, and at the end of that, they're not going to find that passion again for something else. And they're going to drift back into the world or whatever they're doing and be just as happy with it. Being able to understand the personas involved in innovation, whether it's the scientist or, you know, the idea person or what I would call the innovator, the people with the ideas, as opposed to the entrepreneurs, the people who have the skills to, they know when and where to take risk, and they are masters at manipulating their organizations into doing things the organization didn't think was possible. It takes an entrepreneur to actually take an idea or an innovation and ensure it's ever delivered. And so that's why I talk about the language of understanding, you know, what are you really doing and what's your role in this environment?
Yeah, so that's all part of the innovation doctrine then, is it, to sort of understand the roles of the people and who should be assigned to what roles in the process?
Yeah, I mean, I think it helps you understand who's a temporary part of the team, who's a supporter. When you think about it, if I have to come up with different ways of funding things, who are the finance people in my organization who understand the innovation pipeline or understand the doctrine, who understand their role in supporting us getting things done? Well, they may not be part of the permit team, but they're our go-to people when we hit a roadblock or a blockage or something and have to get past it. So, building out from the core innovation team, you have to be able to find nodes within all the other organizations that you touch and figure out who the go-to people are that are going to help you actually continue to make progress. I tell folks, you know, innovation is more a sociology problem than it is a tech problem. It's about getting the right people aligned to make the tech move.
Yeah, and getting them to work together.
Yeah.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about risk. So, you know, there's a lot of talk in the business world about risk and being risk averse and so on. Now, with your background and with the rapid equipment force, the risks of doing things wrong or not doing things at all were quite different in terms of, you know, impact on human life, to be quite blunt. So how do you see people's attitude in business to risk around innovation?
So I think it's interesting because I'm writing a piece now on risk. And it dawned on me, you know, real recently that as an infantryman, I've been trained for years. I've been trained, you know, the combat training centers, I've been in combat. I realized that in my training, I went through iteration after iteration of rehearsals of practices. And I tell people I've died on the battlefield in training in more imaginative ways than I ever thought were possible. But in the process of failing and dying, I started to understand where I could accept risk and where I shouldn't accept risk based on the organization I was with and the people. And eventually over time, I got really good at recognizing that, you know, the same people can behave differently in the day versus the night when they're hungry versus not hungry or what confuses people. So risk was always a constant measurement of, if I don't accept risk here, then I'm pushing that risk downstream someplace where eventually I'm going to have to accept it. And I'm either going to have the resilience to withstand failure, or I'm going to have to look for the opportunity to exploit it if I'm actually good at it. The risk has two ways. You have to be able to deal with the potential failure, but you also have to deal with the potential of, I took a risk and it worked out really well. Now how do I exploit that? So don't waste the opportunity. It dawned on me in the business world that there's no training ground like there was for me in the military. I made some hard decisions in combat that involved whether people would live or die, and they didn't always live. So I know more about personally accepting risk, the leadership of risk, and whatever else. I was a bit surprised when I got to the business world, and even from a innovation and entrepreneurship aspect of, I couldn't find a place where a business sent their people that was like the combat training centers where I learned things, where I actually went in and did things in practice and got coached and I failed. And I had a guy standing there to say, okay, where do you think you failed? When I actually learned from every one of those things, I think that Silicon Valley and all these other innovation places have done a great job of starting at the university level and moving into startups and everything else. Is every startup is an opportunity for somebody to learn to fail. And many have. I think about talk about Steve Blank again, who had five colossal failures for startups. Five. Two that did okay, and one that quite frankly was a unicorn. The whole premise for Steve's journey at learning was he wanted to know why he failed and why he's successful. I flip it on people and say, without Steve's failures, he wouldn't have grown the confidence to take the risk that led to the two that did okay, that would have led to the learning that did to the unicorn. Well, hopefully that makes sense. You can't get the confidence level to make hard decisions about accepting risk without having failed at some things. then understanding what the risk you're actually taking versus what risk you're just pushing downstream. And I think that's missing from what I call the leadership dialogue at the corporate level, and even at the large defense, enterprise level, is we've got people and we keep telling them, I want you to take more risk, but we can't define what is that. And we don't have a place for them to go practice with actually supervised and given feedback that leads them to the point where they have enough repetitions at going through something that they recognize where they personally can accept risk and where the team can accept risk and where they should not. That takes time to actually figure out.
Hmm.
I don't know, there's a very long answer, but we could talk risk all day long.
Yeah. it's a great answer. And I think it's, maybe there's a secret there. I mean, how can an organization or how can startups set up a development program where people can practice taking risks where, maybe they feel safe and they might explore different things so that they can then learn from them?
And I think that's the issue, particularly in the corporate environment, is, everybody's worried about their evaluation. They're going to be scored lower than somebody else because they took a risk and they tried something and it didn't work, versus the person who takes no risk and is always good at what they do and they do perfect. I would take the person who's fallen down 5 times and learned a bunch and learned some confidence about where they did succeed over somebody who's never taken a risk at all. In fact, people who've never taken a risk at all, like, they scare me, because the first time they have to, my fear is they'd be overconfident.
Yeah.
And won't recognize the signs that they're in trouble.
Hmm. Yeah, well, there's that great story, and I can't remember. I think it was Henry Ford, that one of his senior managers made an investment or something, and it didn't pan out, lost millions and millions of dollars. And then Ford had him come into the office for a review, and the guy had his letter of resignation there. He said, well, I know you're going to fire me. Here's my letter of resignation before you do that. And Ford said, why would I fire you? I've just invested X million dollars in your training program.
I think that's exactly it.
Hmm.
I think the question is, how do you invest in the time and energy and give people the repetitions of making decisions in an uncomfortable environment where it's murky it's not a case study. You're it. You got to get out to do that. That's kind of the premise for the Hacking for Defense class or Lean Launchpad. The goal was to give students the opportunity to learn about entrepreneurship, but actually treat them like a startup. So we don't give them all the answers. There's no pat slides. You give them the process, and we'll teach you about the process, but you have to go execute. You're going to make the decisions about pivot or not pivot. I'm not going to tell you. I'm going to tell you when your data sucks or when your premise sucks, or when I don't think you've talked to enough people or what. And I'm going to help you get the assets you need to actually learn, but I'm not going to do the learning for you. And I think that experiential learning is so peculiar to what I got in college and largely what I got in a bunch of my career, except I think that's relative to what it was in a combat training center as a young captain, leading my 100-person company in mock combat for the first time and literally dying in the first 15 minutes.
Hmm.
And I did that probably 10 times before I finally figured out the complexity of everything going around me and could think fast enough to keep up with the battlefield. That's kind of what we're doing with students in Hacking for Defense. And what Steve does with Lean Launchpad is we're delivering young men and women into the workforce now who have been through that that really crushing process of kind of running a quasi startup, well coached, well supervised, with terrific feedback about their performance and the way they think, and that makes them hugely valuable to other companies.
Hmm. Yeah, what I love about that kind of process, I mean, it's a real world education, isn't it? It's not the academic education, which is important to some extent, but usually a lot of the academic programs lack that real world experience and some practical, as you say, understanding of how you have to react in a certain environment and the complexity of those environments.
Now, I want to say I've had a couple of clashes with the academics, and you know, we expanded hacking for defense now to 40 universities in the United States, 7 more in the UK, and we'll be back in Australia this year, I promise you. An academic came to me and said, well, my dean says there's not enough rigor in this course. And I can laugh and say that this has all the rigor of real life, and the rigor of real life is vastly superior to what you deliver in an academic course. It's harder. It's much harder than you think it is. Stanford students, you know, arguably in the top, you know, 0.001% of the students around the world, graduate students, who have been at Stanford, you know, by the time they, you know, got a master's degree for 6 years, will tell you that this is the hardest class and the most professional rewarding that they've taken in the entire time they've been there. And what they say is it is the one class that allows them to use everything they learned in class, every network they've built, every mentor they have, in order to work on a real problem with real people that gives them a real education that's relative to getting a real job.
Hmm.
That's what they have to say about this single course and why it's so popular.
Yeah. Okay. So where are you running the course in Australia?
I don't know yet. We actually ran a pilot in Australia. Oh my goodness. Probably 3 years ago. And quite frankly, at the time we didn't know enough about the ecosystem and the relationship between DSTL, the Australian Defense Department, universities, and the corporate environment. So, but actually, I think the first year they did it, there were four, and lots of people moved around, and it kind of died down a little bit. We have a team in Australia now of Australians who are resurrecting it, and I think we'll likely see, you know, this spring, at worst next fall, a number of universities come back in and it become a tool for the Australian Ministry of Defence again.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. All right. Well, this has been absolutely fascinating, Pete. We could go on talking innovation for ages, and we will come to some innovation during our buzz round, which I think is a good point to move on to that now, our innovation round. It's designed to help our audience, who are primarily leaders and in their field and specialists, to get some tips from your experience. So I've got 5 questions on innovation. Hopefully you'll give us some really insightful answers and inspire the listener to go and do something awesome today as a result. So the first one I've got, and I think you might have answered it already, but we'll see what you say this time. What's the number one thing anyone needs to do to be more innovative?
I think at the end of the day, you actually have to be willing to go out and do discovery. I mean, individually, if you want to be more innovative, you have to be more inquisitive. You have to go look for problems. You have to go look for ideas. You have to go look for the people who you can combine in one place to actually deliver things. And you have to figure out how to use every sociological trick in the book to get small groups of people to collide and catalyze on something and then get them to drive forward.
Hmm. Yeah, I love the idea of adding that connecting people so that the ideas and the sparks can collide. That's certainly a big one as well, because you can't do it on your own, can you?
No, and nor should you. It's not a one-person game. You know, I tell you, the more diverse a group you have in a room, the better off you are.
Hmm. Which comes back to floating ideas past the people that are likely to pull it apart first.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Hmm. All right, what's the best thing you've done to develop new ideas?
The best time to develop new ideas in crisis, because you have no choice.
Hmm.
Well, I'd say that's when it normally happens. that the best time is to develop new ideas before you have a crisis, so you have something to pull from in crisis. And I think that's endemic to, you know, how we've described the innovation pipeline. And it's not that you're going to do one thing with the pipeline. The pipeline is really how you source ideas, people, technology, and problems, get them to collide, curate the best opportunities, then do discovery around them to determine, you know, whether you actually have a viable problem, you really understand you're working on the right problem, you have a potential pathway to delivery, and you can feasibly meet the requirements of the user before you try and incubate a solution and then scale it to something else. In order to innovate, you actually have to have a pipeline that delivers thousands of ideas and problems and people and things with the opportunity to collide in order to actually scale and deliver maybe 10 things. It's almost like, you know, people make investments. You'll look at thousands of things before you decide to invest in something. And then you're going to invest in the best of the bunch. And then you're going to determine which one's going to be a unicorn. Innovation is kind of the same way. If you don't have a constant flow through that pipeline, you're going to find yourself in crisis looking for something that's not there. And in those delays, we talk about the loop. That's why the loop slows down, because you have to go find something rather than very rapidly be pulling things together.
Yeah, that's a great concept, the pipeline, innovation pipeline. And I think that, you know, talking about crisis, I mean, you raised the examples earlier of Uber and Airbnb and the hotel and taxi industry kind of, you know, they found themselves in crisis suddenly and were scrambling to react to that, and obviously weren't that successful in coming up with alternative ways to combat these new business models.
You know, I think so. And actually, I was just starting to look at, I traveled for the first time since last March, about a week ago. I went back to our offices in Palo Alto, and I never even considered staying in a hotel. I stared in Airbnb. Yeah, because very clear on the site, everything they had done to ensure the place was clean and they were gapping. So I think the Airbnb is still doing it. They're still disrupting the industry. They are going to be the first ones to enter back into the taking care of people who are traveling. And I think it's going to be difficult for hotels to wrap their head around until they, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see what happens to them.
All right. Now, do you have a favorite resource that you use most often?
Say that one more time.
Do you have a favorite resource that you use most often for innovation, for in the work you do?
A private guru. Steve Blank, Alex Osterwalder. I am blessed with, and I will tell you, building a company from a four-person startup to 50 some odd people with offices, you know, in multiple places around the country and around the world. The gift of being a mentor, or the gift you get from mentors like Steve Blank and Steve Weinstein, Alex Osterwalder, and the other people that have been part of this process is just phenomenal. I could not have asked for better mentorship than I got from a group of people who weren't there to pat me on the back and tell me how good I was doing. It always starts with, you know, if you really had a big idea, it would sound something like this. And that's what they've been really good at, is not giving me answers, but actually pushing and shoving and kind of pointing it in the right direction. So that's my go-to group of people. I probably, if I don't talk to Steve Blank every day, it's probably every other day about one thing or another.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great to have those mentors, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, what's the best way to keep a project on track?
Pay attention to it. You know, it's a question of keeping a project on track. The way I articulate it is, projects are always at risk of derailing or at risk of missing the opportunity to accelerate them. So I don't look at it as necessarily as an opportunity. That, you know, being concerned about keeping it on track is, I'm concerned about a project getting to a point where there's an opportunity to rapidly accelerate it or do something much bigger. And I'm concerned that we'll miss it because we're too focused on dotting the I's and crossing the T's about project management stuff.
Mm.
That's all important to do to do it, but that can't be the focus of the project managers. That you really, and particularly in the entrepreneurship world, is the job is to look for opportunities to find acceleration. Get back to that OODA loop. Any yeah. chance you can take to get ahead and see that opportunity, you have to seize it. Otherwise, somebody's going to take it away from you.
Hmm. Yeah, I love that concept because I'd never kind of made that connection. And I always, I mean, I'm very process driven and I do project management, but I often find myself doing what other people would probably describe as skipping steps or not following the classical project management system and so on. And in a way, it's looking for that rapid acceleration. I think you've just kind of switched a light bulb on in my head.
You know, I wrote an op-ed here in the United States not too long ago that essentially was focused on the concept of why, despite the fact that we do all the right things, do we keep failing?
Hmm.
And part of the story I tell is I found our deployment timelines were getting longer and longer and longer for certain technologies. And to us, a day was a miss. I mean, if we're talking something slipped a week, it was a major issue.
Hmm.
And in talking to a program manager one day, he was telling me all the things he was doing to keep the contractors who were working on something to tow, where he was saving money and making them do everything that was contractually required. And at the end of the conversation, I was horrified because these were startups. And essentially what he would do is if the startup sent in a bill or an invoice and it wasn't perfect and didn't completely match something else, he'd send it back to him.
Hmm.
I'd say, you need to redo this. If you realize with a startup, if I send an invoice to you and I have a payroll coming and you delay that invoice and that payment and my payroll hits, I still have to pay that payroll.
Yeah.
And I have to go find that money. And what we were finding was that nobody was paying attention to, well, if this goes past a certain day, what'd you just do to this guy's important to us. So yes, you have to hold him to a standard, but that means you may have to get on the phone at 10 o'clock at night, 2 o'clock in the morning, and walk this guy through how to do it correctly. But your job is to make this person successful, and don't just look at the obligations of doing the contract right. But look for places where, hey, we're making progress here and we think we can actually go faster and further for the dollars we're spending. That's the part that's important to us. And you have to teach people that those are the things that are important. You have to allow them to take some risk to fail at dotting the I's and crossing the T's in order to look for those opportunities.
Hmm. Yeah, I love that. That's a really practical example of one way to go about it. And it involves people having the passion and the desire to actually find those opportunities for accelerate and then take the extra step to reach out and help others.
Yeah, absolutely. There was a point in time when I was doing, I think, probably $100 million worth of work on the West Coast of the United States. And I was really concerned because I didn't have any program managers out there. They were all on the East Coast. And my concern was these are fast-moving, barely understood technologies, and we were integrating them in a way that hadn't been done before. So I call them fragile. Really important if they were successful, but they were fragile by, I had, way too many startups working with one another who don't always get along, who need somebody that, firm grip on a wheel to make sure everybody's doing the right. But the way I explained it to people is my biggest concern was not that they would fall apart, but was because we didn't understand the space well enough that we wouldn't recognize when something significant happened. And we would just allow the project to go on its timeline rather than seeing something substantial happen and doubling down on what we were doing and put more money into it and making it move faster. That was a real concern of mine.
Hmm. All right. And what's the number one thing anyone can do to differentiate themselves?
Get educated, get practice, get out there and actually get experience. That experience will lead to a confidence level of knowing when you're accepting risk and when you're really not. The confidence comes from repetition of doing things. And you have to, that repetition has to be made in an environment where you're uncomfortable, where there is a risk of you failing and doing something. So, I mean, that just the persona that you build, having done that and understanding where you can be resilient, which means if I fail, I'm still okay, versus where you're not. Because that really does define where you're willing to accept risk and where you're not. Most people, it's a very narrow pathway, but the more you do this, the wider you get and the more opportunities you can work back and forth. And I think that's the way I have people today is that's the kind of talent we're looking for, is people who are confident but smart. And they understand where they're taking risk and whether or not.
Okay. And certainly, you know, I think there's lots of people in business that are still very risk averse, or if they do fail, they have, you know, their confidence is shaken so dramatically that they really struggle to get back up again from a failure.
Absolutely.
My business coach always says there's no such thing as failure, it's only feedback, and I love that whole philosophy.
I tell people the only failure is if you fail to learn from something. Not learning is a failure. Everything else is an opportunity.
Yeah, that's good too. All right. Well, thanks, Pete. This has been really great. Now, where can people find out more about you and about BMNT and the Growth Hacking Labs and the work you do?
You know, absolutely. You can check out our website at bmnt.com. We actually do a lot of writing about what we learn, what we see. You can check out h4d.us, which is the Hacking for Defense website that really covers all of the university work that's being done. And then finally, you can check out commonmission.us. which is the nonprofit that we spun out of BMNT that is focused on supporting mission-driven entrepreneurs, you know, wherever we find them, whether it's inside the government or outside the government doing things. So all three organizations are kind of tied to one mantra, which is this idea of using mission-driven entrepreneurship to actually go after some of the real hard, intractable problems in the world. We think it's largely a sociological problem, and we just need to build a bigger bench of right-minded entrepreneurs to see the world with.
Great. Love it. Okay. Well, we'll have links to all those in the show notes as well, so people can click straight through and find out more. Do you have some parting advice today for the listener, Pete?
Oh, my goodness. More advice. You know, I think the parting comment I would make in terms of advice is not that they counsel your fears, but actually that the art of discovery is probably the fastest way to get over your fears. And that's the pitching on MVPs to people who you don't know and being receptive to their feedback will teach you a lot about yourself, about how you communicate, about how you receive feedback and how you change based on it. It you know, it's such an educational process when you have an idea and immediately look for other people to share it with, not for them to tell you how great you are, but for them to give you feedback on whether or not you're even getting an idea across or whether the idea has legs.
Yeah, that's wonderful advice. And in some ways, that's actually a low risk approach, isn't it? So it's the whole philosophy behind the lean methodology. I mean, don't invest a lot of time in an idea unless you've tested it with other people and tested it with maybe a more critical audience rather than people who are your fans and are just going to tell you that's a wonderful idea and try to pat you on the back without being critical about it. And then you can chalk that one up to a failure, which you can learn from if people say, no, that idea is no good.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely true.
Great. Love it. Okay. Well, finally, Pete, who else do I need to get on the Innova Buzz podcast for a chat and why?
Oh, my goodness. The other guy you might consider at some point is Steve Weinstein, who is Steve Blank's best friend for years. Steve is also a serial entrepreneur, but he spent a lot of time working on technologies for Hollywood. He's got some fascinating stories about technology in Hollywood and how things happen, but he has been around for years in this space, working innovation both with Steve Blank and with Alex and with me and other folks. And he's got a really interesting and take on how it all comes together as well. I think there are, I'd say a host of really bright folks out there that quite frankly have great stories, whether it's from the space industry or from commercial places as well. So I love hearing people's stories that have been involved in the entrepreneur space. So I personally don't think you can go wrong with somebody regardless of what they've done.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll reach out to Steve and maybe get an introduction from you and have him on the show as well to have a chat.
Absolutely.
Thanks so much for sharing your time and your insights with us so generously today, Pete. I've really enjoyed this. It's been wonderful to kind of hear about your journey and some of the lessons that you've taken out of your military career and applied into business and some of the innovative things you've done with setting up the educational opportunities for startup entrepreneurs in particular and innovators. So all the best for the future of that. If you do come to Australia post-COVID when we're allowed to travel again, you'll have to check, you have to contact me in Melbourne and we'll have a beer or a coffee together. And in the meantime, all the best and let's stay in touch.
No, that's my goal. I'm looking forward to coming to Australia and spending a month or so and just hanging out with really cool people and doing things. So I will take you up on a beer in Melbourne.
All right. Great. Thanks. Right.
Thanks so much.
I hope you enjoyed that really informative and insightful conversation with Pete and took something away from his episode. For me, the key insight was the idea of practicing risk-taking in a simulated training environment to learn when, in real life, it's reasonable to take risks and that you are practiced with the process and how to quickly pivot when you need to. I'd love to know what you took away from Pete's episode. Leave a comment below the blog post, which you can find at innovabiz.co/Pete Newell. That is PETENEWELL. All lowercase, all one word, innovabiz.co/Pete Newell. You'll also find contact information for getting in touch with Pete there, as well as links to the BMNC website, to his social media pages, and the other resources we spoke about in our conversation today. Pete suggested we have a conversation with Steve Weinstein, co-founder of Kynetrope, on a future InnovaBuzz podcast episode. So Steve, keep an eye on your inbox for an invitation from us to the InnovaBuzz podcast, courtesy of Pete Newell. Tune in again to the next episodes of the InnovaBuzz podcast, where we've got yet more fantastic guests lined up, including Simon Leslie of Inc. Global and communications specialist Janice Tomich. Thanks for listening to this episode. Make sure you subscribe to the show to be reminded of new episodes. It's free to subscribe. Leave a review if you like. Even if you don't like me, I'm okay with that. I'm asking you to leave a review because it helps other people find this show. Go to innovabiz.co to join our marketing transformation community and access a free gift my team and I made for you. It's the Marketing Master Mini Class. We want to give you everything you need to transform your marketing into a human-centered, relationship-focused growth engine. Until next time, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Remember, be awesome and keep innovating.